backup going as well. Between one of these, we should be in business.
Yeah, I got a good battery. We can plug it in over here, too.
I think we're all right.
Okay.
This is my almost worn-out microphone here.
It's just not going to work, is it?
Okay, there we go.
Can you
all right,
hear me?
This one's good. This one's working. I'm going to listen through these earphones just for a minute to see if I can hear exactly what's recording. Okay. So, today is March 11th, 2011. We are in downtown Chattanooga at the office of Mr. Hank Hill, the law office, at Cherry and 7th Street. And I'm going to take these microphones, these earphones off now. I'm Rob Shepard from UNC Chapel Hill, and I'm talking today with Mr. Hill about his experience with the Tellico Dam debate, controversy, and so forth. So what I usually like to do, let's just kind of start at the beginning of your where you grew up exactly, and just some of your kind of more memorable childhood and family. We're going to go all the way through.
Okay.
Things like that. Let's start there.
Well, I was born here in Chattanooga at the base of Lookout Mountain in the community called St. Elmo. Grew up here. My father actually grew up in the same community. My mother was a war bride from Wales. She was a elementary school teacher in World War II in London during the Blitz. My dad met her in England. Had one sister growing up. Idyllic childhood. It was a very middle-class neighborhood. Everybody knew everybody. Everybody knew everybody's parents. My father and I had the same first-grade teacher.
That's amazing.
And ironically, later in high school, we had the same class sponsor, a lady named Catherine Pryor. But my mother taught at the elementary school that I went to. I still have several friends from growing up, which is unlike most folks. It would take at least both hands to count my close friends that I've known since I first remember knowing people.
Right.
went to a military school for the 7th, 8th, and 9th grade. One of the worst experiences ever in my life. Did not fit in well with that. Went to Baylor School here in Chattanooga.
Okay.
It's not a military school anymore. It was at the time.
Okay.
Went from the expensive private military school in junior high to public high school, same high school my father went to.
Which high school?
Chattanooga City High School.
Okay.
Which at the time was probably as good a public high school as there was in the country. And we had wonderful teachers. I was a very active outdoorsman. I enjoyed fishing of all sorts, but trout fishing was my passion, at least back then. And ironically, I go trout fishing probably once every other year, and I want to go to Montana.
Right.
But fished in the Little Tea even before the NEPA litigation took place, the National Environmental Policy Act.
Okay.
Fished
Little Tea is Little Tennessee,
Tennessee River.
Yeah. Okay.
But I did most of my fishing actually on the Tellico side of that watershed, the Tellico River.
Okay.
It's basically a two valley drainage basin. And the Tellico, the lower portions of the Tellico River were also impounded by the Tellico project.
Okay.
And then Tellico comes from the Cherokee village of Tellaqua.
Okay.
I'm getting ahead of myself, though.
But okay.
I loved to fish. After the NEPA litigation, I presumed that all was lost until I went to law school. Many years later, went to UT undergraduate school, I was a fairly unremarkable student.
I know the experience.
You know, I was. It was in the heyday of the Vietnam War, so I had, even though I despised the military school, I was an ROTC's undergraduate, and was the first brigade sergeant major to be. I got that position when I was a sophomore at UT. But thanks in part to some extent to the military school, because I knew the field manual 22-5,
right,
backward and forward, and I could dismount on M1, that sort of thing, and then later an M14. So I was a brigade sergeant major. In those days, everybody presumed that if you weren't in college, you were going to go to Vietnam or at least into the military in some aspect. So I very foolishly, back in those days, presumed that, well, if I was going to go, I ought to go as a and be as bad as I can be, so I was
right.
Going to be combat infantry.
Right.
And then, luckily, and in those days, if you could have ROTC for your freshman and sophomore years without going into advanced ROTC, which, of course, puts you into the Army.
Okay.
And in your junior and senior years, you were actually signed up to be in the Army, and as soon as you finished your senior year, you're going to the Army.
Yeah.
Well, the very first draft lottery, I was sitting in an apartment with two of my friends I'd grown up with, Jake White and Charlie Willett, and our dates and our cocktails and our, you know, hors d'oeuvres, and the first numbers called, and it wasn't any of us, and yahoo, you know, we'd have a drink and
right.
Eat some peanuts. And
right.
The second number called up was Jake's, and he was a zoology major at the time. He was in the Army and gone within 2 weeks.
Good grief.
Because of his background in zoology, he was he became a medic.
Okay.
And so from that, he was a helicopter medevac medic for his first half of his tour. The second half of his tour, he was a medic in a heroin withdrawal hospital. It's ironic, he says that the medevac helicopter is not nearly as dangerous as the heroin withdrawal hospital. Anyway.
Good grief.
To end that part of the story, the friend Charlie, we got number 128 or something like that, which gave him time to join the Army Reserves. And man, he didn't go to Vietnam. But finally, number 361 was drawn, and that was me,
mm-hmm.
which meant mm-hmm. there was absolutely no possibility that I was going to Vietnam or going to be drafted.
Huh, okay.
The next morning, I went down and turned in my duffel bags full of stuff and all my ROTC stuff, and the commanding officer of the regular Army comes out and says, "What's going on?" I said, "I got 361 in the draft lottery. I don't have to go.
Yeah.
I ain't going."
Yeah.
He says, "Oh, no, you can still join. Don't worry." And I went, "I appreciate the thought, but no, I'm not going."
Uh-huh.
So that probably more than anything, I guess, in my early life, changed my life, because I presumed I was going to go to Vietnam. I was going to go over and fight and do whatever I should do. And from that, my studiousness probably suffered even more, because I knew I didn't have to stay in school. I didn't have to maintain the hours to not be drafted.
Okay.
So that gave me more time to hunt and fish, which I took full advantage of.
Mm-hmm. Get me clear on the years again that we're talking about.
Well, I graduated from high school in 1967.
Okay.
Having realized how much fun I was having in undergraduate school, it took me 5 years to complete that, so in 1972.
Okay.
And at the end of that, I'd always decided, and I'd changed my perspective on a lot of things. I had longer hair. I had a different persona than you know, when I was worried about going to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And enjoyed life. Well, you know, I'd like to say, UT back in those days was almost free. It was so
mm-hmm.
reasonably priced to go to school.
Right.
You know, if you worked any kind of nominal job, you could pay your way and pay your way into school. My first quarter at UT, the tuition was $78. That was a lot more money then than it is now, obviously.
Right.
But it certainly was an insurmountable amount of money.
Right.
And so just about anybody that could get in could go. I had a bunch of wonderful faculty members at UT. But most of the time, most weekends, I'd be fishing or, you know, or playing anywhere out in the woods. And graduated from undergraduate school with a degree, with a BS, with majors in political science and history.
Okay.
And minors in religious studies, philosophy, and psychology. And I had lots and lots of hours, but
right.
I was very well educated, right. You know, or very well exposed, if not educated.
Right.
But I decided I was going to go to law school. In those days, law school was a very, very conservative institution, UT, than anywhere else. And it never crossed my mind to even apply anywhere other than UT, because I was fairly confident that while I didn't worry about getting in so much, it was because I did quite well on the LSAT. I was in the 99th percentile, and my 2.7 undergraduate GPA combined with the LSAT was enough to get me in UT. But in those days, it was all men. It was all white men.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them literally wore suits to school.
Wow. This was 73.
73, yeah.
Okay.
73, or I think it was actually January of 74.
So, okay.
Because I was out for a little bit of time between law school and graduate school. I had been accepted to law school, and I'd been, you know, given my day to come down and get all my stuff together and, you know, my sign up for classes and that sort of thing. Well, I got down there, and I was wearing my bell-bottom pants and my flip-flops and my ponytail. T-shirt, and I walk in, and it's like Charles Manson walked into a Catholic mass. I was like, what is this? Why is this guy in our law school?
Call security.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if there had been security, I would have called him, believe
right.
me. But we had a dean of admissions then, E.O. Overton, who somehow or another had conveniently lost my acceptance. Now, of course, I had my acceptance letter. And my letter telling me to come down to this particular day, but his response was, he was looking up and down, and said, you know, I'm sorry, you can apply for next semester.
Huh, I'll be darned.
And I said, that ain't going to happen. Mm-hmm. Well, as it turned out, my mother, who I derived some of my character traits from, had gotten a PhD in the United States, and she had a teaching certificate and a college degree from Great Britain.
Okay.
But Tennessee would recognize that. So while she was a substitute teacher, she went to what was then UC, the University of Chattanooga, and then got an undergraduate degree, and then got a Tennessee teaching certificate, and then got from UT in Knoxville a master's degree.
Okay.
Commuting. And then from that, did a PhD program. Well, one of the folks that she was closest to in the PhD program at that time was the chairman of the board of UT.
Okay.
who she called and explained to him what happened. He called me. I went to his office, documented what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
This is all in one day.
Mm-hmm.
While I'm in his office, he calls Ken Penninger, who was the dean of the law school, and says, Mr. Hill's on his way back over there. Put him in.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's going on with you guys, but it ain't going to happen.
Yeah.
So I get back, and lo and behold, I'm back in. which pissed Dean Overton off beyond comprehension, because nobody had ever done that to him.
Right.
And he was the absolute ruler in law school.
Right.
And all of a sudden, here's this jerk with a you know, bell-bottom pants, a T-shirt, flip-flops, and a ponytail in his law school.
Right.
And he wasn't. He did not like it, and then
right.
he let me know that for the entire time I was there. But I thought it was a great way to start, you know. Everybody knew who I was, you
right?
Know?
Right.
And the law schools, you know, I was there for four total years because I got involved in Teleco. But in those 4 years, it changed, you know, the full 180 degrees. So that by the time I left, there were several black students. There were lots of women, and not nearly the percentage that are there now. But uh, the faculty liberalized dramatically.
Yeah.
And part of that process was Zig Plotter, who's my environmental law professor, who to this day is probably one of the brightest legal minds I've ever run across.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen a couple of bright ones over the years.
Mm-hmm.
I was just stumbling through law school. I was working at a sawmill to pay my way. The sawmill was owned by my landlord, so and I'd gotten married when in the end of undergraduate school after I'm getting ahead of myself again.
That's okay.
For example, I took a spring quarter off when I was in undergraduate school, and my new wife and I at the time went to Hawaii for 3 months.
Okay.
Another friend of mine who'd gotten drafted kept going to boot camp. At the end of boot camp, if you were assigned this certain P.O. box in some San Diego, maybe where it was, California,
right,
that was AKA Vietnam. A fellow named Melvin Walter, who I hadn't seen in eons, but still recall vividly. Anyway, his wife and my wife were friends, and he and I were friends, and there were several of us that hung around together before he got drafted. He kept going when he'd finished his boot camp. He would leave. And
right.
He'd come back 29 days later, so he wasn't quite a deserter, but he wasn't quite AWOL, whatever the term was.
Right.
And he did that like that's okay, you got to do, five more weeks of boot camp. So he did 5 more weeks. He'd get the new assignment, go to Vietnam, and he'd leave again. And he did that literally 5 or 6 times. And finally, one time, the commanding officer just said, look, we'll put you in a reserve unit in Hawaii if you'll just go. And he said, I'm on the way. Another couple and my wife and I flew out to Hawaii and spent the spring quarter there living in a little house, a little efficiency house on the beach right across from Dillingham Field, which is a little one-strip Hawaii National Guard airstrip.
Okay.
But it's the only place where American planes took off at Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
I mean, and I'm talking about this place was in the woods at that time. And it was the end of the road that goes around Oahu.
Okay.
And ours was the last address on the road, a little stilt efficiency house that actually the water would come over. From the Army base there, where Melvin had to go to work every day, basically, we got an Army cook tent, pitched it in the state park that was next door to our house.
Okay.
So two couples lived in the tent, a big tent, bigger than this room, which is what it was probably 18 feet in diameter, maybe 20 feet in diameter.
Okay.
A circular tent.
Okay.
And lived a very idyllic life. We had to go to work every morning at 7, and then we had the weekends off and had a great time.
Wow.
And I forgot why I was going there, but
let me catch up on a couple of brief. Let me clarify a couple of things. Let's see, what year was you were describing when you and your friends and dates were listening or watching the lottery? What do you remember? Which year was that?
Oh, that would have been, I guess, 1969.
Okay. So a couple of years into your time at UT.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, this is going way back. Your father, was he in the Army?
Yeah, he was in the Army.
Okay. And then he met your mother in Great Britain. She was from Wales. Okay.
But she was in London at the time, but she'd grown up in Wales.
Okay.
I had to go back to that a little bit. Actually, I've listened to an oral history of my grandfather.
Really?
At the University of Swansea.
Okay.
And my grandfather was a card-carrying communist. He was a coal mine organizer. He was banned from the mines in like 1920 or so, charged with sedition, because he organized the Welsh miners.
Okay. Okay.
And in those days, Welsh miners were a little more than slaves.
Right.
And you bought everything you could get came from the company store with company scrip. You lived in company housing. You got a company coal allotment for your heat.
Right.
Hot water, cooking, everything.
Right.
Anyway, so he led a strike at the mines there in Ogmore Vale, near Bridgend.
Okay.
He was tried for sedition, represented himself, and won. He was never allowed to come to the United States throughout my childhood. Now, my grandmother would come over every other year, and we'd go there every other year.
Okay.
For the summers, since my mother was a teacher, had summers off. But my grandfather was never allowed to come because he was a card-carrying international communist, and the FBI would not allow him to come into the country.
Yeah.
So finally, in the Kennedy administration, they lifted the ban against him coming, at which point he said, I wouldn't go to that country anyway. You
know? But, yeah.
So there's a history of defiance, I guess, in my genealogy.
And then, that's really neat. A couple of other catch-up questions. What were the circumstances that led to you going to the military school for, I think you said, 3 years?
The three guys who I was at the apartment, the two guys I was at the apartment with for the draft lottery, Charlie Willett and Jake White. Charlie's mother was and we all lived in St. Elmo. Charlie's mother was a high school teacher at Kirkman High School in Chattanooga. Jake's mother was the secretary of the elementary school where my mother taught.
Okay.
The local junior high school, in their eyes, was less than ideal.
Okay.
Potential for divergence away from education was great there.
Right.
And while City High School is one of the best high schools in the Southeast, Lookout Junior High School wasn't quite so good.
Okay.
So all of our parents, and we were all middle-class people. Jake's dad and Jake's uncle owned a printing company here in Chattanooga. Charlie's dad, his mother was a high school teacher. But his dad was a mason, and after their family company built laid the brick for the Moore Auditorium here in Chattanooga.
Okay.
They all said, if you guys will go to Baylor, we'll all struggle to pay for it. And it was expensive even then. It's very expensive now.
Right.
but if you commit to go, you got to go all 3 years, 7th, 8th, and 9th.
Okay.
At the end of the 9th grade, if you really don't like it, You can all go to City if you want to. And that was kind of the deal.
Okay.
And we all signed on, and everybody was true to their word. We stayed, and we all left together at the end of the 9th grade.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, it was such a class warfare. I mean, we were from St. Elmo. Now, we thought we were in pretty good shape. You know, everybody's parents had good jobs. We had pretty much everything we ever wanted. We lived in nice houses.
Right.
But we rode the Lookout Mountain bus every day, and all these, inbred, elitist, second and third generation trust fund kids.
Right.
From the carpetbagging generals that ran Chattanooga at the end of the Civil War, and the old Coca-Cola money, mm-hmm. and all mm-hmm. the rest of that.
Mm-hmm.
And these kids are no better than we are.
Right.
But we were just, it was just so degrading and demeaning to have to deal with these people.
Right.
And it's kind of funny because we were picked on savagely until about the 9th grade when all of a sudden we started being the same size as as everybody else.
Right.
You have seniors in high school riding the bus, picking on 7th graders. And our bus driver was Wendell for all 3 years. Wendell was a great man, but Baylor went to school no matter what back in those days.
Yeah.
Including snow days when the city schools were closed. Well, Wendell, driving a different route than he was used to, ran over a child on a sled in a Baylor bus.
Oh, my gosh.
And these guys would be in the back of the bus going, baby killer.
Uh-huh.
It was just horrible. Mm. Just horrible. Mm.
Right.
So, in the 9th grade, about 2 weeks left in school, and we were no longer getting picked on.
Yeah.
Because we were big enough that the three of us could take on any senior. We just decided one day on a Friday afternoon that we're going to get even today.
Right.
So we're driving. Baylor's over on Signal Mountain Road.
Okay.
The freeway at that time ended at Signal Mountain Road. The Highway 27 going north.
Okay.
Ended at Signal Mountain Road. So we left the Baylor gates. Wendell pulls the bus onto the entrance ramp. We're going toward the Ojotti Bridge. We just turned around, the three of us, started walking to the back of the bus, you know, beating the piss out of everybody on the way. Well, not everybody, just right. The ones that picked on us.
Right.
And it was so ironic that these people had no concept of loyalty to each other. You know, we were loyal as hell to each other. They had no concept of, you know, there were 12 or 13 of them.
Mm-hmm.
They could have fought back.
Right.
They just couldn't pull it together enough to try to help each other out to fight back. So
right.
I mean, we didn't hurt anybody, but
right.
The main thing we did was the military school. We threw everybody's hat off. We threw their shoes off. We threw their books out. You know, if anybody was wearing a clip-on tie, it went out.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole time, Wendell was going, "Yeah, whip his ass!" He's looking in the mirror, you know. Hit him again, yeah. Well, we presume we're going to get kicked out, but it's fine because it's the end of the year. We ain't coming back anyway. So it's
right.
Never a word was ever said, ever.
Huh.
Nothing. And Baylor was a pretty strict place back then.
Sure.
But I'm fairly confident that what happened was, when Wendell was a very respected person, although not educated and not, other than being a bus driver, not a professional in any
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm.
But he was so well respected, I'm sure he just went back and said, "Look, these guys deserve what they got."
Right.
And they've been picking on these guys for 3 years, and all of a sudden the table's turned and.
Right.
You know, it was over.
Right.
I recall that vividly. It's one of the few good memories from my younger age.
Okay.
Anyway, back to undergraduate school. I spent the time in Hawaii, so, you know, I wasn't in a hurry to graduate. Finally made it to law school. Never any doubt in my mind that the only thing I wanted to do as a lawyer was be a criminal defense lawyer. And so I guess my second year, the first semester, I'm taking environmental law from my name, Zig Plotter. All of my friends are the same friends I had in undergraduate school, or of the same ilk anyway, and they're all wildlife management and fisheries biology
mm-hmm.
graduate students.
Mm-hmm.
Because all we did was hunt and fish.
Right.
And I didn't hang out with anybody at the law school because at that point it was still a very stuffy, non-fun, you know,
sure.
institution. And so my friends would be the guys in wildlife management and other outdoors pursuits. I was at a party one night with all those guys, and I was discussing my upcoming environmental law term paper, the First Amendment aspects of the proliferation of nuclear power, and they're all going, "What?" Well, and the whole premise was that, you know, if, for example, we get, and this was back when there weren't nuclear power plants, they were starting to build them then, as a matter of fact, including the one here in Chattanooga, Sequoia, and was that if you have this enormous proliferation, and if there's a problem, I think you're going to see First Amendment issues stifled. And this, bear in mind, this is a much different time.
Right.
Much, much different time.
Right.
You know, 40 years ago, 35 years ago. When, you know, TVA controlled this place. Big manufacturing and big money
mm-hmm.
controlled Chattanooga.
Mm-hmm.
It was a much different place than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
It was the dirtiest town in the southeast
mm-hmm.
in terms of air pollution. From all the foundries and that sort of thing.
Right.
And you still had J. Edgar Hoover, you know, keeping my grandfather out of the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so it was very easy for me to imagine in that context that, you know, if there's a major nuclear problem, they're going to shut everybody down.
Right.
Or would have at that point in time. I don't think it would happen today. But it was very facile then. It was all this, you know, paranoia about the government, that sort of thing. This guy's going, "Oh, God.
Uh-huh.
That's the dumbest damn. Who the hell wants to write, read about that or write about it?"
Uh-huh.
One of my friends, Robert Smith, says, "You need to talk to Dave Ettinger," who was Robert's major professor at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'll get to Dr. Ettinger because he's one of, I respect him phenomenally.
Okay.
But he said he's found this fish in a little teal. And, you know, my ears perked up immediately because I'd fished a little teal a lot. He seems to think that there's a new law that should cover this thing.
Right.
And you ought to go talk to him. I said, "Well, Monday I went and talked to him." That was in 1973.
Okay.
And the Endangered Species Act was brand new.
Right.
In fact, I'd never heard of it. Of course, I was brand new in environmental law at the time. But Zig Plotter, who was a teacher, was a very avid fly fisherman. And
I'll be darned.
Well, I said, hey, I'm changing my topic, and I'll try to put you together an outline. And he said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, there's this little fish and a little tea. He said, Little Tennessee River? Yeah, yeah. And then, well, it's apparently, it's got some sort of federal protection, and it may be a shot at stopping the dam.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, the NEPA folks, the folks who filed the lawsuits under the National Environment Policy Act, that's the one that says you got to have an environmental impact statement if you're going to use federal funds for a project.
Right.
You got to say what you're going to do. So, Judge Robert Taylor, who was the federal judge in Knoxville's time, and a crotchety old guy, if you ever saw one, occasionally wrong but never in doubt,
right,
kind of guy, heard the NEPA suit and actually did a good job in that, because TVA filed this totally inadequate document, listing what they're going to do down there.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to understand the significance of what that valley was.
Mm-hmm.
The Little Tea Valley is its entire watershed is either national park or national forest.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big river. In fact, it was the largest contributing river to the Tennessee River where it came in, at just below Knoxville in Lenore City.
Okay.
And it was a large sandy gravel substrate river, which means the bottom, unlike most of the rivers in Tennessee, which are rocks, this place was little pebbles and sand.
Okay.
Which is what the main system used to be before all the impoundments.
Huh.
All the way up from the Ohio River back to just below, Fort Loudoun Dam. It was at that point the farthest upstream dam on the Tennessee River system.
Okay. Okay.
From Chattanooga, you got Chickamauga. Above Chickamauga, you got Watts Bar, and above Watts Bar, you got Fort Loudoun Dam.
Okay.
Named Fort Loudoun because of the Fort Loudoun, where the English first came over the mountains into the Cherokee country,
mm-hmm,
and established a fort on the Little Tennessee River, Fort Loudoun.
Okay.
Let me digress for a minute. It's funny because there is still a state park there, and the site of Fort Loudoun was still very actively being investigated and, dug archaeologically, and
sure,
there was evidence of continual human habitation for 10,000 years by Indians before the English, and it was right on the banks of the river. Well, now that they've flooded where the Fort Loudoun was, they've rebuilt this little pretend fort up on a hillside, mm-hmm, overlooking the reservoir, which is ludicrous.
Right.
But anyway, back to the NEPA thing. Judge Taylor enjoined them, TVA, from going forward on the project until they filed an adequate environmental impact statement.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all of the naysayers, or folks who are against the dam, had put together these really extensive documentations of what was going to be lost. For example, the entire birthplace of the Cherokee Indian Nation.
Right.
Chota, which at the time the English came over the mountains, had a 1,000-acre peach orchard.
Peach orchard, okay.
Yeah, and the predominant about a 50-acre area where the bulk of the village was,
mm-hmm,
the predominant rock formation is pottery shards, or was. It's gone now. But you'd walk around out there, and you'd have chunks of pottery the size of a quarter that were from the 1500s,
mm-hmm.
And they were everywhere. It's like gravel.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Tokwa, which is a major Cherokee village, Tahlequah, which was where Tellico came from, Tennessee,
mm-hmm,
where Tennessee came from.
Mm-hmm.
All these places are now underwater.
Yeah.
Because of the Tellico Dam, exactly.
Okay.
And the Tellico Dam is what's called an access dam. The Fort Loudoun Dam is on the main channel.
Right. Of the Tennessee.
The Tennessee River.
Okay.
Fort Tellico Dam is about a quarter of a mile from the main channel.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a very small concrete plug, a few hundred feet across,
mm-hmm,
but then the rest of it's earthworks.
Okay.
So they dug a channel between Tellico Reservoir and Fort Loudoun Reservoir. Mm-hmm. So that's the whole theory of the access dam. That way, in theory, if you get too much water coming down the little T Valley, you can divert it over to Fort Loudoun, so you got two different sets of spillways.
Okay.
Well, the reality of that is that the little T Valley, since the building of Fontana Dam, way on up, along with other Alcoa, Tepoco, Tennessee American Power Company dams.
Okay.
But they were all Aluminum Corporation of America, Alcoa dams, for generating electricity for the aluminum smelters in Alcoa, Tennessee.
Right.
Between Knoxville and the Telco project area.
Okay.
Well, since Fontana had been built, the valley had never flooded, ever. Mm-hmm. And that was like 1947, I think, mm-hmm. 49.
Right.
The water quality was second to none. And in fact, before the dam was built, Coors had planned to make its only brewery west of the Mississippi on the Little Tennessee River.
Okay, because of the water quality.
Because of the water quality. And as soon as the TVA condemned all the land and, you know, and filled the reservoir, they'd come back to Coors. Okay, we got you a great spot. He said, we don't want a damn lake. We wanted the mountain water.
Right.
And I might add, they also dumped a bunch of transformers with their PCBs, polyfluorinated biphenyls.
Right.
They left them in the base of the reservoir, along with several bulldozers and diesel oil and that sort mm-hmm. of thing. So, mm-hmm. actually, you can't, in theory, you shouldn't eat the fish out of Telco Dam.
Right.
Reservoir, I mean.
Right.
Which is absurd. It's the cleanest watershed in the eastern United, in the United States, for that matter, not just the eastern United States.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we were all, I was all fired up about it. I talked to Ed and her, and that one of the problems we had, obviously, was the perception that we're a bunch of weirdo, eco hippie mm-hmm. geeks who, you know, or I don't know, don't care about the real things men are supposed to care about and that sort
right.
of thing. But when in reality, the folks that were involved with us, the various graduate students in wildlife management, Ed and our graduate student Wayne Starnes, I mean, these people are tough as steel, mm-hmm. you know, and they're out there. They're out there in the woods every day. They're out there doing it, not just sitting in some office talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Dave Ettinger, who is 745 pounds, you know, could play fullback in the NFL if he set his mind to it. He's just that tough a guy.
Right.
But also not aggressive, but just a very wonderful
yeah.
tough guy.
Yeah.
And he's also a guy that can identify any living creature in North America. And tell you, and I mean any living creature, not just
mm-hmm.
aquatic.
Mm-hmm.
He is without question the premier expert on freshwater fishes in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the biologists from TVA and everybody else were his students.
Right.
And that made it a lot easier for us with inviting mm-hmm. TVA because we knew everything they were doing because all of their biologists were owed their allegiance to Ettinger, not to TVA.
Right.
A guy named Charlie Saylors, who was a very nice guy, and he's still at TVA, as a matter of fact. But we knew everything they were doing. I don't want to publish Charlie's name, too, because I don't know where his retirement now. But,
right.
But, they were good people, too. We didn't villainize them. We villainized Red Wagner and Lynn Sieber, who was the general manager. Wagner was the chairman of the board.
Mm-hmm. Of TVA.
Of TVA, yeah.
Okay.
And had planned to live in one of the villages created on Telco Reservoir. We held up long enough he didn't get to do that anyway.
Right.
Not that I'm still bitter at it. Don't get me
right.
anyway, part of what TVA did, they made a volume 2 of their environmental impact statement.
Mm-hmm.
They just bundled together every exhibit that the plaintiffs had put into the trial. Which,
okay,
of course, documents what's there.
For the NEPA trial or
yeah, for the NEPA trial?
Okay.
The second NEPA trial.
Okay.
And the other thing they did was they filed a volume 3. They contracted out with folks to see exactly what's in the area. So they had the archaeologists from UT talking about, you know, all the Indian stuff and that sort of thing, what they were able to you know, determine where things had been and what was going to be flooded. Which is all they're required to do.
Right.
And then they determined that, you know, most of the land that was being condemned at an average price of $300 an acre, some places where topsoil was 20 feet thick,
mm-hmm.
which is unheard of, even, even in, you know, in the Midwest and the, you know, the cornfields of Illinois, it's unheard of.
Right.
But and with a more than adequate water supply, but never flooded, that most of that, a lot of that land had never passed by deed. It had come from the original land grants when the English stole it from the Indians, and then when the colonists became Americans as opposed to English, it stayed in the family and passed lineally, by lineal descent, not by selling it to somebody else. There was a wonderful lady up there, Alice Warner Milton, and her family's from Chattanooga, but her family originally had a huge land grant on the, in Little Tea Valley. So she was very passionate about it. Her husband, George Fort Milton, ironically, was friends with Wendell Willkie and Franklin Roosevelt, and the TVA Act was actually, and from Madisonville, Estes Kefauver, who was a senator from Tennessee. Estes Kefauver, they ran for president in the, back in the Eisenhower years. They sat around her kitchen table with her husband, and we had an office in Washington also, and then kind of wrote the TVA Act. And it's ironic that later in her life, after her husband died, let me digress for a second anymore. He owned a newspaper called the Chattanooga News. There was a locally owned grocery store chain, the Home Stores, and they had a circular. The Chattanooga Times, of course, was founded by Adolph Ott before he went and founded the New York Times. And so the Chattanooga News and the Chattanooga Times were, I guess, the competing newspapers of the
day.
Well, Roy, what's Roy's last name? Mr. Roy, Mr. Roy, who owned the Chattanooga Free Press at the time and owned the Home Stores, the Free Press was just a circular to advertise his specials at his stores. Thomas Dewey, who at the time, after being defeated by
Truman.
By Truman, well, before he was defeated by Truman, but was he was head of Con Ed. And he came to Chattanooga with $100,000 in a briefcase. This is all well documented. Gave it to Roy McDonald, who owned the Home Stores, because both the Times and the Chattanooga News were pro TVA, and the Con Ed obviously was anti-TVA because they wanted to make private power, not have public power. So they came and gave Mr. Roy $100,000 in cash to outcompete the Chattanooga News and the Chattanooga Times. Well, you know, the New York Times was more valuable than Con Ed probably at that point in time, so there wasn't much he could do to the Times because their pocket was deep. But the Chattanooga News, he started virtually giving away advertising, and made, rather than having a circular in his little grocery store, made it the full, made the Chattanooga Free Press a competitive newspaper. Well, the Chattanooga Free Press put the Chattanooga News out of business. George Fort Milton killed himself. The Chattanooga Free Press bought out the assets of the Chattanooga News with the money from Con Ed, and they became the Chattanooga News Free Press, which I thought was an ironic name, News Free Press. And then lobbied against TVA from its inception.
Interesting.
Yeah, but anyway, but so Ms. Milton was a wealth of information, but by the time Teleco came along, everybody was just so gung-ho pro-development at any cost. The Chamber of Commerce guys, the guy that sold Caterpillar bulldozers and all that sort of thing. That they were four square in favor of it, too. Now, Teleco was first proposed in, like, 1942. During the war, to get more energy to Alcoa.
Yeah.
To you know, to help, and aluminum was important in the war effort, obviously building airplanes and all the rest. But it was just tabled after that until the '70s.
When
the '60s?
Yeah. Right. Okay. So when do you remember when you kind of, when did you first become aware of the plans for Teleco? And so before you got to, before 1973, and you're changing the topic for your term paper.
I was aware of Teleco from the mid to late 60s, because when I was in high school, you know, especially in the spring, mm-hmm. you know, our guys I ran with, our parents said, okay, if you'll go up in the Teleco planes and go on up into the campground at North River, you can go Thursday afternoon and not miss school Friday.
Okay.
So, when the opening day of trial season was the first Saturday after the 15th. The first Friday after the 15th of April. So that let us go up there on Thursday afternoon. We'd camp and start fishing immediately. Mm-hmm. And it was so remote back then that mm-hmm. It's like our parents would much rather be up there, you know, 25 miles from civilization, where once you got up in there, you're going to stay, even if you had a six pack of beer.
Right.
You weren't leaving, you know.
Yeah.
So much less trouble to get into up there than anywhere else mm-hmm. in the region.
Mm-hmm.
So I was aware of it from the mid 60s, probably.
Okay.
Because I'd fished it by then.
Right.
And the Teleco River was small enough that you fished that on foot. But the Little T was such a large river that you go up to Hoss Holt's boat dock just below Chilhowee Dam, which is the dam above Teleco Dam.
Okay.
And that's in the really steep part of the watershed.
Mm-hmm.
So the only significant part of the river that was left was the lower 16 miles of the 32 miles that make up Teleco Reservoir.
Okay.
And the lower 16 miles of the big sandy gravel substrate river, that's why the snail darter was there.
Okay.
Anyway, okay. I've gone too far back. Anyway, so part of what TVA did in their analyzing what all is going to be destroyed, they hired Dave Ettinger
mm-hmm.
to catalog what was going to be lost aquatic.
Uh-huh. Oh, and so that's why he was looking around.
That's how he got there.
Okay.
And he and Wayne, wearing wetsuits and snorkels and flippers, started about a mile, 17 miles from where the dam is upstream.
Okay.
And then went into the deeper, bigger river. And it's cold water. I mean, cold mm-hmm. water. But they had what were called slurp guns, which is a little vacuum
mm-hmm.
tube, you know, a tube about that long,
mm-hmm.
that big. And if you get close to something...
Hold that thought. Let me flip this. So I'm flipping the tape on my backup recorder. So you were, I interrupted you when you were talking about
slurp guns.
Right. Carry on.
Anyways, and this will give you a perspective of just what kind of person Dave Ettinger really is. He's going down through here, down through the river with a mask, with a slurp gun, and this little tube that, with a vacuum on it. When you pull the trigger, it fills the tube with the water that the mouth of the tube is close to. And if you got a fish there, it comes in with the water.
Okay.
So he's going down through there. He sees, and Dave, and understand that there are probably 100 species of darters,
mm-hmm.
different species of darter in Tennessee, North Carolina, and Kentucky.
Okay.
Which is the most aquatically diverse ecosystem in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Dave's swimming down through there. He says, holy cow, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen that. He mm-hmm. slurps it. He sees another one. He slurps it. So he collects three or four that day. And this is a guy who looks at this thing, and he's identified every aquatic species in North America
mm-hmm.
for freshwater.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I've never seen this. And a lot of these darters look a lot alike.
Right, right, sure.
And so he goes back to his office with Wayne in the lab. They're looking at these things. They're looking down under the microscope. He says, I've never seen this. However, I've seen something very close. and that would be the stargazing daughter, mm-hmm. West of the Mississippi, in the White Saline systems in the Ozarks.
Okay.
Very similar rivers, the White and the Saline, or sand, big sandy gravel substrate rivers.
Okay.
And also very clean. And the key aspect of that clean is lack of silt.
Right. Okay.
Darters generally don't have, all darters don't have air bladders. So, like, unlike a bass, they can stay at, 6 feet to 12-foot pond. Mm-hmm. Darters are on the bottom.
Okay.
And the only way they can move is to paddle their fins, hence the darter.
Okay.
And the only way to get off the bottom is to paddle, because they have the air bladder. So he realizes immediately, he's seen this, a very similar fish in the White Saline systems in the Ozarks.
Amazing.
And it's even more amazing because, the difference is just a few scales below this or that fin. Otherwise, they're very, very similar, but they don't interbreed. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. the reason for that is when the Ice Age brought the glaciers through, carving the Mississippi Valley, the snail darters were on the east side, mm-hmm. the stargazing darter was on the west side, mm-hmm. and they evolved differently. Mm-hmm. And that little bit of evolution over those tens of thousands of years made this pectoral fin scale mm-hmm. more numerous than that pectoral fin scale. And this is a guy that looks at that and says, "Oh, what? Look at the difference here."
Mm-hmm.
What difference?
Right. Right.
But it's a unique lesson in ecology, and that, this really is the physical Darwinism. It really is what happened.
Right.
These things are different because thousands of tens of thousands of years ago, they were split apart from each other by an impenetrable barrier, and one grew up this way and the other one grew up that way.
Right.
And I realize he's never seen it before. He starts putting together his report back to TVA. And the darters are members of the perch family.
Okay.
So the snail darter is Persina Amostema tenace. The Amostemas are that particular species, that particular family of darters. So it's a perch, darter, and the species name is tenace after the Cherokee Village, which was the namesake for Tennessee.
Okay.
Etnar starts putting that together, and that's when he tells the folks in his class, "Hey, I may have found something that's put a stop to this," because literally a few months before that, the Marine Mammal Fisheries Committee in the House and Nixon had signed into law the Endangered Species Act.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, it was the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and so it was designed to protect dolphins and manatees and that sort of thing. But the Endangered Species Act made it protect all creatures.
Right.
Whose habitat is threatened or is about to be destroyed. And it's critical habitat. Not all habitat, but habitat that's critical to the survival of the species.
Okay.
So I go over and talk to him, and Zig says, "Oh, you need to flesh that out and come back and talk to me in a couple of days." Well, I was so excited about it, I went and fleshed it out on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's back before you had internet.
Yeah.
Access, and back before all the law was still in books.
Yeah.
And I'm going through and I'm looking at the federal code and I look at the Endangered Species Act of 1973 and it fits perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Etnar's already begun the process of describing the fish by using the analysis of the stargazing darter and the Saline and White River systems. He realizes that this fish requires this particular substrate, mm-hmm. and the reason you don't see it anywhere else is because that substrate's gone.
Yeah,
it's all silted in. It's all reservoir bottom now.
Right.
He begins the process of identifying the particular species. Well, I read this law, and there's already one case that's been brought about it. And I look at this case, and that's the. Or two of them actually at that point. The Devil's Hole Pupfish out in Death Valley. And Devil's Hole is a spring. It's basically a straight down cave. And so when the water table is normal, 30 feet down into this hole, there's water. And
right.
at one level, there are ledges around it. So if the water is where it's supposed to be, mm-hmm. the ledges are just are a foot or so deep.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's where this Devil's Hole pupfish breeds.
Mm-hmm.
So when they started pumping out too much water, the level goes down, that ledge is gone, the next ledge is gone, and then it's the water table is sinking because they're pumping all this water out into Death Valley to grow wheat or you know, cattle fodder or whatever else.
Right.
Well, the way that was solved is put a marker. You can't pump below this marker. Mm-hmm. Easy enough to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
The other case was the Mississippi Sandhill Crane, and I-10 was being built at the time, you know, along the southern United States.
Oh, right.
It's just north of Panama City and goes from New Orleans to Jacksonville. And there is an intersection that's going to be built, and it's a habitat, a swamp that's critical to the subspecies, the Mississippi Sandhill Crane. Now, there's lots of sandhill cranes,
mm-hmm.
But that particular subspecies, habitat was critical to their breeding.
Okay.
Easy to fix. You know, you just put a bend on the road over here and a bend on the road over here, and instead of making the intersection here, you make the intersection up here where the bend is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might add another, you know, a few miles to the interstate, but it's an easy fix. It's not
right.
terribly expensive until you comply with the act.
Right.
But in both of those cases, the bottom line was the act had to be complied with, and everybody looked at it. You know, the Department of Transportation and whoever was in charge of the water out there in the West. And said, here's the way to fix it.
Yeah.
And by there, TVA, on the other hand, had the attitude of, no, there's no way to fix it. You mm-hmm. want to stop this project? We ain't going to stop the project. We're God. You're not.
Mm-hmm.
Shut up and move.
Mm-hmm.
So I go back and talk to Zig, and I get in the outline. I show him the two cases. I show him the act itself. I give him a paragraph of what Etnar says, and he says, you know, I'm so aware of the little T. But I specifically chose never to fish it because I didn't want to lose it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go fishing.
Mm-hmm.
We did.
Mm-hmm.
And on that day, we just decided, okay, let's evaluate exactly everything we have to do to get this fish listed under the Endangered Species Act
mm-hmm.
and pursue the mm-hmm. litigation.
Mm-hmm.
So part of getting it listed was to get it described, which Ed and I worked 20 hours a day on. We filed with the Department of Interior to list the fish as an endangered species, and that's part of the process. You have to list the animal.
Okay.
And the Department of Interior has to make a finding that, yes, this is critical habitat, yes, this species is endangered, and yes, this particular federal project will have a significant impact on it.
Right.
At that point, TVA began to fight us tooth and nail, bureaucratically and...
Mm-hmm.
With the Tennessee delegation, or the TVA delegation, Kentucky, Alabama, Tennessee,
okay.
some northern Mississippi. And
so you mean the Congress people from those within the TVA's region?
Service area,
okay.
Yeah. The TVA delegation.
Okay.
You know, they began to cast us as these weirdos and you know, people that don't care about progress of man and all the rest of the stuff,
mm-hmm.
they're only worried about this little 3-inch fish. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and they were very effective at swaying the entire mindless media from CBS to, you know, the Jackson Sun-Times and Jackson,
right.
Tennessee. And
right.
We were vilified. We were vilified in the local papers. And finally got the listing. Once we got the listing, TVA went to work 24 hours a day clearing the reservoir basin I think it's 21,000 acres, and there was 3,000 acres of stream bed, so it's a 24,000 acre project.
Right. Okay, I've seen a number similar to that.
I'm not positive about it, but they had condemned an additional, actually 16,000 acre reservoir, and they condemned 32,000, something like that.
Okay.
For shoreline redevelopment.
Right.
Well, that was part of their benefit cost analysis.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be so much benefit because once we build this reservoir, this land's going to be a whole lot more expensive in value, and we can redevelop the reservoir frontage
mm-hmm.
as second home property for all the, you know, the middle management people in Ohio and Indiana that are retiring, and we'll bring them all down here, and boy, life will be a whole lot better for everybody.
Right.
That'll be so valuable compared to our paltry investment.
And it'll be privately taxable?
Well, in theory, yeah.
Okay.
Well, the theory was that everybody will want to buy this to develop it, that we'll make huge money at the outset.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the only problem with that huge money at the outset is you're making it from land that you've stolen from individuals.
Right.
You know, and I say stolen in its most realistic sense. These people didn't have a chance to sell their own land. It was taken. And and you don't even get a jury trial mm-hmm. when TVA condemns your land.
Mm-hmm.
You get a TVA assessment, and that's it.
You can't contest the price.
You can contest it, but you don't get a jury. You get a judge.
Okay.
You get a federal judge.
Okay.
Obviously, the same guy signs his check and signs TVA's check.
Right. Okay.
So these people their land. You talk to some of these folks in here if you want to, because there are people who had 100 acres. 0.2 of an acre was going to be flooded. Their entire 100 acres was condemned.
Right.
It's so funny now that would just be abhorred if somebody tried to do that now. Oh, you're going to redevelop all this farmland into private golf courses and stuff like that, but you're taking the land from these folks to do that? Well, then
right.
They'll be tolerated now.
Right.
Again, a different time back then.
Right.
Anyway, they began work 24 hours a day clearing the reservoir basin. They started at a place called Coyote Springs,
okay,
which is close to where the snail darter was first.
How do you spell that?
Coyte.
Okay. Okay.
And the first thing they cut were these five or six yellow birches, under which the Cherokees signed the first treaty with the white man, and they were still there. A river birch is ordinarily, a few inches in diameter. These trees were several feet in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
Huge,
mm-hmm.
huge.
Right.
And very healthy. Cut them down. And then just obliterated the area. Beautiful place.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they did that just as a, because it was sort of a rallying spot for us.
Okay.
And they did it just about, okay, boys, watch this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So we go to trial, and Judge Taylor, who had a fellow named Boone Daugherty, who's a lawyer in Knoxville. Zig, of course, is a brilliant guy. Yeah, we'd never been in a courtroom. We didn't know what it looked like.
Right.
Definitely not in a big federal courtroom fighting TVA. And Boone, very sharp guy, an excellent trial lawyer, agreed to do our side for $10,000 through the Supreme Court, which was... That didn't cover expenses for the years of litigation that we had.
Sure.
Of course, now we did a lot. We did all the research and wrote all the briefs and that sort of thing. But Boone put together a wonderful trial. We deposed all of their people. They deposed ours. We, pointed out the errors in their position, and finally goes to trial. We not only beat them, we beat the hell out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, Judge Taylor says, and when he finishes the arguments of counsel after the trial, says, does anybody know how much that two-year injunction under the NEPA litigation cost? Well, a guy named Beecham Brogan, who was a retired head of the legal division at TVA, in the back of the courtroom, unsworn, not a witness, never been in the trial at all, just watching,
mm-hmm.
says $30 million. Just out of the damn stands,
mm-hmm.
this guy yells this, and Taylor goes, well, it might not have been 30, whatever the number was, $30 million. It was probably $10 million at that point, because the whole project was supposed to be like $19 million when it started, and it ended up being hundreds and hundreds of millions.
Right.
But, I can't issue an injunction if I'm going to waste that kind of government money.
Yeah.
Well, but we had established what we had to establish under the Endangered Species Act to require an injunction. And one of the things that Hill versus TVA, or TVA versus Hill, this was actually ended up being reported, established was if you got a violation of federal law, a federal court has to enjoin it. It's
right.
a mandatory
okay.
injunction.
Okay.
A federal court can't allow a continuing violation of a federal law. I just said it made that principle.
Yeah.
And so We got to the Sixth Circuit. The Sixth Circuit says, what the hell has gone on here?
That's an appeal?
That's the appeals court from, from our local district court. The district court for the Eastern District of Tennessee, which is Knoxville and Chattanooga and up to Johnson City.
Okay.
And issued an injunction. But between that time, TVA totally obliterated the reservoir basin. And kept throwing money in.
Mm-hmm.
But the only money that was irretrievable, because they built new bridges, they built new roads and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. but all of which were still totally functional without a reservoir.
Right.
The only money that was lost was $2 million worth of concrete on the actual plug there on North City.
Mm-hmm.
All the rest of it was still totally usable,
mm-hmm.
and the reservoir basin would have regenerated itself in 50 years. I mean, you know, the Smoky Mountains National Park was cut
over.
Yeah, I mean, you know, 125 years ago, 150 years ago.
Right.
It's pretty damn cosmic now, you know.
Right.
So it could all come back, but TVA starts, you know, beating the pass of the congressional doors. We're going to lose this $100 million we've got in there. We'll lose it all.
Mm-hmm.
Which was totally a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And for that matter, the land had appreciated so much over the several years that this had gone on that they could have sold the land for its present value and paid back all the money that had been put into it, including all the earthwork, the roads, and everything else.
Right.
But I didn't advocate that, obviously.
Right.
But...
so you're at the appeals level.
Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals says, you know, enjoin the damn thing. It's a violation of federal law. TVA's known this the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
It's incontrovertible. This is federal action that'll have a significant detrimental impact on the survival of the species, and this habitat is critical to that survival. At that point, TVA puts on the blitz, and you know you got CBS down here, and you know ABC comes in. I can't remember the guy's name now, but he's now a very conservative commentator, and Bernard Goldberg.
Oh yeah, right.
Bernie Goldberg comes down, and he's blowing smoke up everybody's ass about how wrong this is, and of course it gets on CBS, and it's a bunch of eco queers down here trying to do all this bad stuff to our economy.
Right.
But we did at that point begin to get a little bit of credibility.
Mm-hmm.
And
why?
Had,
what was different?
Well, among other things, Jimmy Carter got elected.
Right.
And another little aside, I used to go up to Washington at least every couple of months for 4 or 5 days, just bang on doors. And then, of course, the folks outside the TVA delegation, Congressman from New York, who was the chairman of the Merchant Marine Fisheries Committee, whose name I can't recall right now, but he was our ultimate ally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Ted Kennedy was our ultimate ally
mm-hmm.
in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the guy from New York got nailed in the Abscam thing, so he went away.
Okay,
John Murphy. But we used his office, and the same year that that Carter came in, I was flying from Knoxville to Washington, and I missed my plane.
Mm-hmm.
And so Knoxville had a small airport. I'd go up, like I say, every month for 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
Just keeping everybody hip to what's going on, because all the national environmental organizations did not support us because they thought it was too trivial.
Right.
You know, if you're going to do a test of the Endangered Species Act, wait till you get a bald eagle.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
It wasn't a bald eagle, it was a snail darter.
Right.
Same concept.
Right.
It's the canary in the coal mine. If the canary dies, get out of the coal mine. But we had great support.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of the TVA delegation,
mm-hmm.
even though Howard Baker was the kingpin of the Senate, even he didn't realize how much support we had in the Senate.
Right.
So I missed my plane, so I get rerouted to Atlanta, from Atlanta to D.C. On the plane from Atlanta to D.C., I, for whatever reason, there were no more seats on the plane, I got bumped to first class.
Okay.
And I sat behind Hamilton Jordan.
Okay.
On the way up, it was, you know, Carter's main man in the White House.
Right, right.
And I thought, now I can't let this go by. So I wrote on front and back of a legal page, not too much, you know, legal
right.
page, but you know, a pretty concise statement of what I'm doing. Actually, about a page and a half, because the back side of the page wasn't filled.
Okay.
And I still have it—the note from Jordan that he wrote back and gave me all the phone numbers of folks calling. Luckily, we knew most of them.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Allman, who was one of our fellows, used to date Cyrus Vance's daughter back in college, so he knew how to get hold of Mr. Vance.
Okay.
You can't buy that kind of connection. You know,
right.
we fell into it.
Right.
And that wonderful environmentalist Al Gore came to town, and he had the worst office in the entire House office buildings. He had to walk up the last flight of stairs to get to his little office. And of course, his dad, Al Sr., was the biggest whore that ever approached TVA, and he was tight with him.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he became chairman of the board of Peabody Coal Company, where TVA developed their their Muhlenberg County mine, whatever the hell it is.
Okay.
So it's what the John Prine song is written about.
Okay.
Al Gore Sr. became chairman of the board of that after he left the Senate. But Al Sr. was talking about what an environmentalist he is.
Yeah.
Well, we think, okay, he's in fresh.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a good start. I got to talk to
Al Jr.?
Al Jr.,
okay.
Yeah.
All right, I'm with you.
And just when he came in the same year Carter did.
Okay.
As a freshman congressman from Middle Tennessee.
Okay.
And I thought, what the hell, we go talk to him? So I'm in there talking to him. And he says, you know, God, I'm so glad. I couldn't understand what the issue was, but I knew you guys are still hanging on, and you keep winning, and you're still here, and it's all these years later. This has to be a worthwhile thing to look into.
Right.
I want you to not back you 100%. I'm an environmentalist, and this is wrong, and,
mm-hmm.
and I'm gonna back it. We're going to change all this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hell, I walk out. This is not only a crack in the TVA delegation, this is a damn hole.
Right.
This is going to be big for us. Even if he is a freshman congressman, it's going to be big that we got somebody. And all the damn people, all the rest of the House and Senate members that we had in our pocket or on our side, all said, you've got to have somebody at the Tennessee delegation. We have the TVA delegation.
Yeah.
We have to have somebody from the TVA delegation to say, yeah, this is wrong. Let's go about it a different way. Well, so I have this, and I walk back into Murphy's office, and I'm going, you know, yee-haw, we got it. And this, he had this legislative assistant lady who's, you know, and I'm saying, no, Al Gore, he's going to back us. He's on our side. He backs us 100%.
Uh-huh.
And she's going, yeah, you stupid, ignorant, redneck, dumbass. You've been doing this 3 or 4 years. Are you that damn naive? I'm going, no, I just talked to him.
Uh-huh.
So I follow her back in through the labyrinth of the office, back to Murphy's office. He's got his feet up on the desk and he's talking on speakerphone to Al Gore, and Al Gore's saying, there's a bunch of eco-hippie nutcases trying to stop this much-needed dam in Tennessee, and
mm-hmm.
the people don't want that, and this is a critical project, and
mm-hmm.
yada, yada. And I'm going, you son of a bitch.
Uh-huh.
And whenever I would hear him talk about his environmental motives, and I'm talking about, mm-hmm. lying bastard.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so
we couldn't
get the chink in the armor.
Yeah,
but we still had the votes. At that point, Supreme Court has ruled.
Okay,
we win.
Right.
Howard Baker immediately says, We've got to change this act. We got to amend this.
Yeah.
So it's not so black and white and ironclad. And you know, if something's more beneficial than some last little species, we can go ahead and wipe it out.
Yeah.
So they come up with what we call the God Committee, and that was either 7 or 9 people to be on a committee to say yes or no whether the species survives or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the burden of proof was if the project significantly outweighs the value of the species, then you go with the project.
Right.
So it's the Secretary of the Army, on behalf of the Corps of Engineers, the Secretary of the Interior, the Chairman of NOAA, National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration,
mm-hmm.
Secretary of Agriculture, a representative appointed by the Governor of the State, and a few more people, whoever they were, I can't pull off the top of my head now. But they had hearings. They had one hearing in Washington and one hearing in Knoxville. And the hearing in Knoxville was the final one. And John Duncan gets up there, and he was a congressman from Knoxville at the time.
Oh, right.
He said, oh, yeah, we're ready. It was a very normal, quiet, rational hearing. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, I think the Secretary of Interior was the master of ceremonies. And he says, okay, does anybody make a motion that we continue with the project? Total silence. And he said, so nobody is in favor of continuing the project? Silence. He said, then I move by acclamation and we end the project. Unanimous. Mm-hmm. You know, the God Committee voted unanimously to can the project. Mm-hmm. Well, hell, we were elated. We figured we've done it now. Mm-hmm. It's done. We won. Shortly after that, Jimmy Carter comes back from the Camp David Peace Accords. They have a joint session of the House and Congress, of the House and the Senate, and in which all, you know, Begin and whoever the Israeli guy was, Begin and Sadat.
Right, right.
They're there and they're shaking hands and everybody's happy, and so they retire, but they never end the session. John Duncan files an untitled amendment to the appropriations bill. And that was always TVA's position. Oh, they've been giving us money, so Congress must want us to complete this.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
There were two people left in the House, Duncan and some other guy. And Duncan introduced this amendment, you know, House bill, whatever, number. I move that it, and this is, you know, this is on the congressional record, I move that we pass this by acclamation. Well, the other guy says, I second and I agree. Well, it's just mm-hmm. the two of them, so hell, it's mm-hmm. done. Mm-hmm. And that amendment said, Tellico Dam shall be completed, state or federal law notwithstanding.
So that's the exemption.
That's how it came through.
Okay.
So we're thinking, okay, they snookered us in the damn House, because we would not have lost the House vote.
Yeah.
They snookered us in the House. We go to the Senate with the same appropriations bill amendment. Also with the guarantee that don't worry about it, Carter will veto it.
Mm-hmm.
Because at this point, he's completely on our side.
Yeah.
And we had Stu Eisenstadt, who was his chief of staff or something like that. He was on our side. And then we, you know, we could talk to these people.
Yeah.
Citizens off the street could talk to these people.
Right.
And we had gotten a fairly savvy politically by this point, and had raised a fair amount of money, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, selling T-shirts and, you know, hats on the hat and stuff like that.
Okay.
It was very expensive to go to the Supreme Court, because mm-hmm. back then you had to print all your briefs and stuff. I mean,
okay.
Typeset print.
Okay.
Just put into them word processor, you know, the computer and crank it out.
Yeah.
And on your copy machine, but you could do that back then. So it was very expensive to get stuff out. And, of course, traveling and the rest of that stuff was expensive. We win, and I do not recall the exact number in the Senate, but we win the first seven or eight votes. And the first vote, we won handily.
Mm-hmm.
Howard Baker keeps saying, I want to recount, I want to revote.
Mm-hmm.
The whole time, going around twisting arms, saying, you know, you give me this, and I'll give you
right.
three of those.
Right.
And you give me this, and I'll give you, you know, a new bridge to wherever the hell you want it to go. You know, everybody got to work together. So we keep,
yeah.
The first vote we won overwhelmingly. The second vote we won not quite as overwhelmingly. And finally, about the seventh or eighth vote, we lost by two votes. And we're thinking, well, Carter's going to veto it. Well, mm-hmm. Carter gets mm-hmm. the Jim Sasser, who was our senator at the time, along with Baker. Sasser was a Democrat. Calls Carter and says, if you don't sign this legislation, you haven't clicked off yet.
No, we're good.
If you don't sign this legislation, I'm going to support Ted Kennedy in the Tennessee primary. well, two issues there. Ted Kennedy was one of our biggest supporters, and I thought he was a fine man. He may have had a couple of minor flaws, but so did Jesus, you know, so we got to let that go. But and secondly, Ted Kennedy couldn't have gotten elected anything in Tennessee.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Tennessee was just so reactionary and anti, you know, the new society and all that, the great society and all that crap. And
right.
He couldn't have been elected to anything. And it would, but more importantly, I don't think he would ever run against Carter. And he damn sure wouldn't run under the threat that if you don't complete Tellico Dam, I'm gonna dis-support you.
Right. Right.
Anyway, we go through the thing, and we're waiting for Carter to fly. He's flying over Knoxville, and Air Force One, to wait for him to call. He calls up and says, and that's shortly after. You remember the photograph? I mean, probably not old enough, but there was a rabbit that was the photograph. It looked as if the rabbit was chasing Carter.
Not really.
Anyway, it was, you know, it was no big deal. But all of the soon to be Reaganites used it as a great publicity gimmick against Carter.
Like, yeah.
Look at this geek, he got Elmer Fudd out there. The rabbit's chasing him.
Uh-huh.
And they actually brought that up. Look, you've already been chased by a rabbit. You can't be around the town by a damn 3-inch fish. You got to sign the legislation. So Carter goes, I'm sorry, I got to do it. Huh. That's his history.
Okay.
Let me digress it a little bit though. A guy named Robin Beard, who was a congressman from West Tennessee, Republican, later got beaten, which is unusual. West Tennessee is a lot more Democrat than, at least it was then, than East Tennessee, which is much more Republican.
Okay.
But he got beaten, so he later became the secretary of the ambassador to NATO. But at this time, he was congressman of West Tennessee, and as a courtesy, every time I was there, I'd go by and say hello and give my hand out to everybody that's in the TVA delegation. Then I'd go out mining for other potential people outside the delegation.
When you say hand out, you mean some printed material?
Yeah, you know, okay. Just here's refuting things that TVA said, all their economic figures, and they were talking about all the barge traffic that would be going up Tellico. There's never been a barge through the canal to this day.
Okay.
Other than, you know, something, you know, a construction barge that they're putting some up there to build, you know, some new golf course condominium or whatever.
Right.
And no, there's been no barge traffic as far as, you know, hauling out manufactured
commercial
goods,
traffic,
you know, that have been manufactured up in the Tellico area. And there were all these damn lies. Boeing was into the thing at one time for a community called Timberlake, which is going to be based on all the model communities in Northern Virginia, you know, and Boeing pulled out and says this will never work, and we'll sell it to somebody else. As it turned out, in the end, all of the condemned land, or the vast bulk of it that wasn't in the reservoir, was given to the three-county development agency, who gave it away to all their cronies to build all these golf course communities and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So none of that actually ever panned out. But and they were talking about the increase in hydroelectric generating capacity. Well, there was no. There are no generators in Tellico. It doesn't make electricity.
Right. Right.
And then they say, well, but we can use the extra head coming through the canal to make Fort Loudoun's much more efficient. Well, you know, it increased TVA's generation capacity like by 1/1,000th of a percent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you could damn near light a match under a, you know, a windmill and generate the same kind of electricity.
Yeah.
So I'd hand them out and you know, give them information sheets and respond to things that TVA had been up there blowing smoke up their ass before. And we had been, you know, steadily, month by month, year by year, we got the TWRA, Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency, Tennessee Wildlife Resources Commission to endorse our side. And just, you know, little by little, we kept doing better and better. But I was in there visiting Congressman Beard one day, and you know, then these people were so fucking rude. But, you know, I'd sit in his office for an hour, and I'd made an appointment, and he'd walk out with a entourage. Oh, hey there, Mr. Hill. Just drop that on my desk. Well, I'd like to talk to you just a second, Congressman. Well, come on, you can walk with us as we're going. And this is one of those times, and I was tired of it.
Yeah.
And he had this guy that was his, you know, some tobacco chewing West Tennessee redneck, moron who was part of his entourage.
Right.
And so the guy says, well, come on, Bill, let's you and I go ahead and go do this. And Bill, and whatever his name was, Bill says, no, I think I'm going to stay here with the congressman and listen to this environmentalist pick all the green specks out of this chicken shit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought, motherfucker. Mm-hmm. Wrong thing, pardon me, my French on this tape. But, you know, I'm not going to tolerate that today.
Right.
And I said, what did you say? And he said, yeah, I just want to hear you pick the green specks out of this chicken shit.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I said, you son of a bitch. I paid my way here. Mm-hmm. I'm paying your way here.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to talk to me like that. Come on outside. I'm going to whip your ass right now. Well, I mean, the guy was bigger than I was, but he wasn't nearly as mad as I was.
Right.
So, you know, they start to, oh, God, you know, this guy's going to start to threaten to fight us.
Uh-huh.
And, oh, hell, they push all the security buttons and stuff at the damn Capitol Police. Come out. No, you don't need the police. Walk outside. Come on out. You're such a bad man. Walk on out here.
Right. Right.
You know, they said, well, sir, you're causing problems. I said, no, I'm just, this guy just insulted me. And I'm just, now that we know he's a chicken shit, I'll be glad to leave. Not to worry.
Right.
You coward. You know, that's what I mean. It didn't do us any good. It wasn't going to make any difference because Beard was never going to vote for us anyway.
Right.
But it made me feel better that day.
Right.
And ironically, I was going to visit relatives in England and was in the... What airport was it? Maybe JFK, I think. And then I was sitting there waiting for the plane going to London. And... lo and behold, sitting across the area was Howard Baker.
Uh-huh.
And I walked over there, and he looked up and went, well, hey, Hank. And I said, Senator, how are you? Oh, I'm fine. Fine. I said, on the way to London? He said, yeah, I'm going to speak to the American Bar Association, you know, annual meeting in London. And and yada, yada. And how you been? Been great. I said, well, you know, I just want you to know that you really put up a good fight. So I appreciate that, sir, and I want you to know you're still wrong. And he smiled at the very least. It wasn't so bad, but it was. Other than losing, it was a wonderful experience. I learned a lot that I could never have learned without it. I'm a much better lawyer for having done it, because we used to go testify at all these hearings, and you know, you'd have, for example, Malcolm Wallop, who was from Wyoming, and he was. You know, he was mocking us. Y'all are crazy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, I can't remember her name now, but I'll look at her name in a minute and tell you what it was. But anyway, she's testifying.
Okay.
And they've stolen her land. And Gene Ritchie. And, and she's there to testify about what has happened to her and her family and people like her and her family.
Right.
And Wallop makes some sort of big deal kind of gesture. And she said, I tell you what, if you're so casual about this, you live in Wyoming, right? You got a ranch? Yeah, I do. Give me your ranch.
Mm-hmm.
Give me your ranch. You've stolen my farm. Mm-hmm. Give me your ranch. What do you mean? Well, she just drilled him.
Right.
And by the end of it, he said, oh, my God, she's right.
Yeah.
And we changed his vote.
Right.
You know? But once you get these people trying to grill you, I mean, Bill Brock, who's a senator before Sasser, he and Baker were in the, and he came in because the committee Baker was on, and they're trying to drill. I mean, we were right. We had the right answers,
mm-hmm.
and TVA was lying, and we caught them lying every time.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you get used to dealing with that kind of, you know, powerful damn people with their entire staffs trying to drill you, and you drill them back,
right.
it gives you a sense of confidence that. You know, you don't get anywhere else, I can tell you.
Right.
And you realize, hey, I put my pants on the same way this guy does, and I can drill him.
Right.
It feels good. You know?
Yeah.
And then, of course, we won all the major battles and lost the war. As a matter of fact, the first time I went back up there, I had a little intern, a high school intern, that was forced to spend like 28 hours with me over the past year. And so we were about 6 hours short.
Oh, I see.
And so I said, okay, and she wants to want to be a lawyer, but she wanted to be an environmental lawyer, and unfortunately in Chattanooga, I'm the closest thing we've got, and I haven't done much of it in the last 25 years either, but I drove up there for the first time. I drove all around. It was maybe sicker than I thought it would.
When was that? Which year was that?
That was 2 months ago.
And that was the first time
that I'd gone back since they closed the reservoir.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I've driven across the canal on Highway 321 in Lenore City,
mm-hmm.
where you can see the concrete plug, but I've never gone into the project area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was just when I was going to Townsend, the back side of the Smokies, that I've driven across it. But I never had gone back, and I was more offended than I thought I'd be.
Yeah.
Because you got all these, you know, retired Midwesterners playing golf and, you know, mm-hmm. pretending that they're living out in the country,
mm-hmm.
and they're $400,000 lakefront homes or golf course front homes and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And that's what I went around Fort Loud, that they'd rebuilt overlooking the reservoir.
Oh, right.
Where Fort Loud used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, and it's kind of funny because Hoss Holt, who was the guy that up below Chilhowee Dam would rent flat bottom boats back in the old days. That's how you fished it. You'd get a link of chain tied to a rope, put the chain out behind your boat,
mm-hmm.
and the chain would slow you down just enough so it'd take you about, you know, it'd take you 4 hours to float 10 miles fishing the whole way.
And okay.
The little T would raise stocked trout faster than a hatchery.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put 10,000 fingerlings in a hatchery, and you put 10,000 fingerlings in a little tea, the ones in a little tea would grow faster than the hatchery-fed fish of natural.
Which kind of trout?
Well, rainbows and browns.
Okay.
They stock brooks. You know,
okay.
Not native brooks, but eastern brook trout.
Okay.
And it was such a heavily fished fishery that it couldn't sustain itself but there was natural reproduction of trout. Probably the only significant reproductive water source in Tennessee.
Okay,
You got brook trout up in the smaller streams, and they're naturally recurring, but they're going away fast, too, because of all sorts of different issues, increasing water temperature and the rest of that.
Yeah.
But you could throw in 10,000 fingerlings, and next year they'd be catching size.
Right.
Which is pretty cool, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, when I went up there, Hoss Holt's place was still there. It's all closed down now. And Hoss was a cool old country guy. But the way they co-opted him was that if he would change his mind and support the project, they'd give him a marina permit
mm-hmm.
on the reservoir. Well,
uh-huh.
you know, I don't fault him for turning it down. That's how TVA was able to control people. You know?
Right.
If you can't actually beat them down, buy them.
Right.
And actually, when I was in law school doing this project, a guy who was a nice enough guy, but he was a clerk at TVA, a law clerk for TVA, and he said, the lawyers in this thing think you're pretty smart, and you've done pretty good for, you know, now they're going to beat you, of course,
mm-hmm.
but you've done pretty good, and you know, I'm fairly sure that you could get a job there if you want. I said, really? And back then it was like $12 an hour, which was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't like I was rich, you know, but I was getting by. My wife had one car, I had one suit, I mean one sport coat, you know, for doing legal clinic stuff like that.
Right.
Which was adequate. I had one pair of boots, which was adequate. You know, and you could, I'd be glad to. I'm pretty sure I'd get you on there. And I said, oh, that's cool. Tell them to check around. Call
mm-hmm.
them back.
Mm-hmm.
And you know you'd have to get out of that teletech line. I said, fuck you.
Uh-huh.
You really think that I may be a whore, but I'm not a cheap whore. You know, I mean, I'm not a slut.
Right.
I'm a prostitute, okay? You gotta, if you want to talk to me, don't talk about $12 an hour, you know?
Right.
Anyway, I thought I was just thinking, I was baiting him along anyway, because I
right.
thought it was funny, you know? But, yeah.
So tell me more about, tell me more about how you felt when you went back a couple of months ago. What is your sense of what was lost? What do you think has been lost?
Everything's been lost. Obviously the entire valley, or the entire birthplace of the Cherokee Nation's lost. The entire identity of the valley's been lost because what used to be hardworking, you know, decent, simple farmers they've been replaced by these damn yipped out, you know, wrinkled skinned, overly tanned retirees playing golf and pretending that they're in some way out in the wilderness or out in
right.
the, you know, in the woods or out in the country
yeah.
or whatever.
Okay.
And actually, one of the when we had our reunion thing, one of the folks who had been displaced brought up the Teleco Villager or whatever it was called, you know, the little pamphlets of the
right.
newspaper there. And one of the articles in it or our column was way back when. And it was way back when they started building Teleco Village.
Mm-hmm.
How, oh, boy, this is really remote, and,
mm-hmm.
boy, things are really tough. I think to stop.
Okay, I'm going to
rely on
fingers
that.
Crossed, we'll keep going.
Well, and you know, and just the whole character of what used to be a totally self-reliant community and farmers and you know, working folks is all gone. It's just totally gone. Some people have made a lot of money out of it,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of people got totally screwed. And the local people who this was in theory going to help, you know,
yeah.
Lives were going to be, you know, wonderfully enhanced, they're still dirt poor.
Yeah.
That's the thing, any dirt anymore. You know, and they've imported in a whole new culture up there. And
what about environmentally? What did you love about that place? I mean, you've told me a little bit, but tell me more. Kind of, if you can, kind of go even deeper into, you know, fishing and hunting and what that felt like for you and what you really cared about.
Well, and you can't see this over on the tape, but that's what's flooded now.
Okay.
That's what it looked like.
Pre-dam.
Yeah, it's pre-dam.
Okay. So we're looking at a picture
that's
of the,
Nelly, that's
the
Nelly
valley
McCall.
Before. Okay.
Nelly McCall, her house, her property wasn't flooded.
Okay.
She refused to move. TVA came in with bulldozers,
mm-hmm.
with her still living there, and bulldozed her house.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. Marshals dragged her out of it.
Is she still living?
No, she's long dead.
Okay.
I mean, see, if you can imagine seeing something like that,
mm-hmm.
and except the Smoky Mountains and Cherokee National Forest behind you,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. and then now it's all gone. It's just mm-hmm. gone. It's mm-hmm. all underwater.
Mm-hmm.
That's Gene Ritchie that I told you about, the hammered wall.
Oh, right.
And see, there you go. That's the Highway 411 bridge right there.
Okay.
And look what just a perfect place. Look at the mm-hmm. look at the topsoil around it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's the concrete plug there. The $2 million was lost.
Okay.
That's Alfred Davis, who was they moved him off. He was the person that had the 0.2 acre.
Okay.
That was covered by water.
How about him? Is he still living?
Yes,
Mr. Davis.
He is,
okay.
Yeah.
He might be another person to talk with.
That's that Nair right there.
Okay.
That's Wayne Starnes.
So we're looking through the pamphlet or the kind of a small book that was created at the for the 30th anniversary.
Yeah, reunion of Teleco Dam Resistors.
Yes.
Farmers, landowners, sportsmen.
Okay.
That's good perspective. That's Corte Springs right there. That's where they first cut everything down.
Okay.
But you see all the silos out in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
That gives you a perspective of just how inconsequential the actual concrete plug is, because they've stripped the whole reservoir basin.
Right.
But that's the river going through it.
So that's not impounding the river yet.
Right.
Okay.
Well, yeah, the spillways aren't closed.
Okay.
And at that point in time, there were TVA guards out there with M16s with orders to shoot anybody that tried to come close to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was some consideration of cops floated a dinghy filled with stuff.
Right.
There.
Right. And at kind of at the grassroots level, you know, where you were involved and, you know, in the community and the people impacted, what can you tell me about, what was the kind of the atmosphere or the spirit like?
That's Boone Doherty.
Okay.
Oh, it was devastated. I mean,
yeah.
and you know, these people had been fighting. I'd been fighting it for a decade. These folks have been fighting over 40 years.
Right.
From the early 60s to the 30 years anyway.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, that's Lee, Zig, Detmar, Peter Allman, Doris Gove, and Doris's husband, whose name I can't remember. They're the T-shirts.
Okay. So in one sense, you lost the river, and you gained kind of a community of friends and people that cared about the same things.
Yeah. Been a while since I've seen these folks. But that gives you perspective, you know, the farmland, mm-hmm. the river.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the whole sense of community.
It's
gone. It's just gone.
Right.
I mean, there's still a community, but it's not the same community that was there before. And it's a large group of transplants that have taken over these folks' lives.
Mm-hmm.
It was a combination of extreme sadness and just disgust and anger. And luckily, the young lady was with me, senior in high school, so I couldn't go out and shoot anybody.
I
could have witnessed her if I'd ever been doing anything stupid.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know. The real tragedy is all of the stuff that's there now could have been there just as easily without the reservoir.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the reservoir, again, you can't drink the water.
Right.
You can't eat the fish. If they had left the river there, you could have still had that 20-acre thick topsoil and still have the golf courses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. You still have the farms and still have golf courses or whatever else.
Right.
There wasn't any real need to build the reservoir to have the social impact that they've had. In fact, you could have probably done a lot more because it had 16,000 more acres.
Yeah.
And the
economic value could have been there, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, obviously, yeah. Well, there's no industry up there. I mean, there's a fiberglass boat manufacturing company. I mean, that's inconsequential.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have had a Coors brewery up there.
Right.
That would have put a hell of a lot more local people to work.
Right.
With good paying jobs, instead of being golf course caretakers and maids and, you know, lawn maintenance people for all the damn yuppies that moved down to their very inexpensive lakefront golf course communities.
Yeah.
You know, if you move from New York to Delco, it's cheap.
Right.
If you try to move from Von Orr into one of those places, it ain't going to happen because your job won't carry it. You know, you're making $9 an hour.
Yeah. Right. Right.
As a landscaper or whatever, you know. These people are making $85,000 a year in retirement, you know.
Yeah.
And so, and they sold their $600,000 house in Virginia or wherever and bought them a $400,000 house in Tennessee and pocketed the other $200,000. Boy, what a deal we got.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you pay a reduced price for stuff that was stolen from somebody else, you used to call it fencing.
Right.
Now it's called development, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm getting more disgusted as I talk about it. the poor intern I was just getting so mad.
Yeah.
And you know, I'd given her a lot of background and, you know, and we'd talked about it a lot. And I also showed her other important stuff like, you know, criminal courts and that sort of thing, and what I do now.
Right.
But, you know what, I've got another one up here. But I was just getting, she could say I was getting so bad, so she kept trying to make jokes and lighten up. So I was having nothing of it. You know?
Uh-huh.
This was actually one of the better articles.
Now we're looking at it. Atlanta Journal of Constitution, 1977. Okay.
The Atlanta Journal of Constitution Sunday Magazine, Tennessee's $100 million fish.
Okay.
Kind of funny to look back at these things. And here you go. That's a good perspective up there.
Okay. I'll be darned. Look at that. So now we're looking at the dam under construction in this magazine article.
Yeah, the earthworks and the little concrete plug that goes in it. And that's the canal that connects Fort Loudoun and Delco.
So basically what they did is
there.
Where the little T flowed into the Tennessee River, that's where they, that's what they dammed so that the little T would back up.
Right.
Okay.
And then put a canal between the two dams, is what we call an access canal, or access, A-X-I-S.
Okay.
But, that's the original Fort Loudoun.
Okay.
And the river's really? Right here.
Agree.
Well, not the original. That's the remake of the original.
On the site.
Yeah.
Okay.
Those are the cornfields over there. There's, I think that's it.
This looks like, oh, they're moving on to a different, well.
No, that's a
city council or something.
Something different. I don't know what that is. Yeah, that's something different.
Well,
anyway.
I'll write down. I can get that online. Let me, what's the date on that?
It's March 27, 1977.
Okay.
And if I can only think where they were, I got about 50 of these. I'd give you one, but I don't know where they are.
That's all right.
Somewhere.
I can probably pull it up online.
And ironically, after it was over, the dam was built, one of the reasons that there was any support at all in the rest of Congress was our local congresswoman, Marilyn Lloyd, lived in the Brainerd area of Chattanooga.
Okay.
In the 19... the St. Patrick's Day flood of 1973.
Mm-hmm.
Or somewhere in there.
Okay.
There was huge flooding in the what's called East Gate, and there was the Brainerd Village, which was the Brainerd Mission... missionaries, the first missionaries to come into this part of the world.
Okay.
It was at the Brainerd Mission, and there's a place called Eastgate. It's a shopping center that was there. And all of Eastgate was flooded. All of Brainerd was flooded. And ironically, the only place that had been moved around much was the mission site, which is in the middle of the parking lot for Brainerd Village, and it's a
okay.
fenced-in area. It didn't flood because it was higher ground.
Duh,
you know? Somewhere in the Bible, it's about, you know, the wise man builds his house on the rock, the fool upon the sand.
Right.
Still holds, you know. Congresswoman Lloyd testified before Congress, tears in her eyes. If these environmentalists hadn't held up this much-needed Tellico Dam,
mm-hmm.
my home would not have been flooded.
Mm-hmm.
My home would not have been destroyed by the floods.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so pitiful. Well, the reality of it is that, and after the thing was closed, Bernard Goldberg again comes down, I was practicing law at the time, and because they had said, "What's this about Marilyn Lloyd's house not really being destroyed?" That's what you sons of bitches. We told you this all along.
Right.
Why do you ask the question now that the dam's closed?
Yeah.
Why didn't you ask it 5 years ago when it was important?
Right.
So lo and behold, her house that she talked about being destroyed didn't even have water in it.
Mm-hmm.
The water came up to the level of her floor so that she had to replace the carpet
mm-hmm.
because it mildewed. It didn't ruin.
Yeah.
But it didn't even get up into her drywall. And, ironically, about a month after her testimony in Congress, she sold the damn house for 3 times what she had paid for it.
Wow.
With new carpet.
Yeah.
And, far more importantly, is the fact that that flood was caused by South Chickamauga Creek, not by the main Tennessee River Channel.
Mm-hmm.
The main Tennessee River Channel was more than held in its banks.
Mm-hmm.
South Chickamauga Creek, which flows north out of North Georgia into the main channel just below Chickamauga Dam.
Okay.
So it wasn't impacted by Chickamauga Dam or the dams above Chickamauga Dam, which includes Tellico.
Right.
It was impacted by South Chickamauga Creek, which flows into Nickajack Reservoir, which is down in... south here in Marion County, Tennessee.
Okay.
Named Nickajack for the cave that's closest to it that's also got flooded out. By the way, by Bill Nickajack. But so if Telco Dam had been built in 1937, it wouldn't have made any difference.
Right.
And actually, all those places are flood-free now because for about 25 miles, South Chickamauga Creek has a dike around it now.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't flood all of low-lying Brainerd like the airport. You know, the reason you have the airport where the airport is in Chattanooga, it's a low-lying floodplain.
Yeah.
So, okay, you can build runways there, and if you have to close the airport for a few days, that's cool, but you know, you don't want to build dense housing because every now and then the damn things are going to get flooded.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And the whole theory of TVA, it used to be that let's wise people up and don't put their houses in the floodplain. You know?
Right.
You know, he comes down and he asks Congresswoman Lloyd, "Oh, you're impugning my integrity." Well, no, bitch, you lied.
Yeah.
You know, it's that simple. But what was really funny was, he says, "Now, you know, Senator Baker's in town today. We're in Chattanooga." I said, "Okay." He said, "Well, we're going to get an appointment with him and ask him about this." And I said, "No, you're not. He'll never talk to you."
Yeah.
"Oh, wait a minute. I'm Bernard Goldberg, CBS News. He'll talk to me, by God." Uh-huh. "No, he won't."
Uh-huh.
"See, he's in my office." He says, "Oh, you know, hey there, whoever the guy was. It was his advanced man. Bernard Goldberg. Yeah, we're in Chattanooga. We need about 15 minutes of the senator's time." "Well, it's the Telco Dam issues. So there's no time today you can see us." "Well, we're going to be here tomorrow." "He's going to be in Knoxville. We'll drive to Knoxville and talk to him. We won't have time all day tomorrow. We can't get 15 minutes. Then we'll talk to you in Washington the next day. No time then." And I'm on the phone going, I knew you wouldn't tell. Well, that was the biggest problem. We can never get these guys. They're always making these pronouncements, mm-hmm, and issuing press releases. Mm-hmm. That never faces one-on-one.
Right.
They didn't have to.
Right.
And so we can never confront them and say, "Look, that's just a lie. And here's why."
Yeah.
But they'd get away with it. And so anyway, Bernard Goldberg gets to about like 5 days off. And then finally says, "Well, what do you mean you can't schedule a week off? You can't schedule a week in advance." "And I've given you 7 days, 15 minutes in these 7 days, and you got time."
Right.
"What's going on?" And he ain't talking to you.
That's,
that's it. That's what's going on.
That's called the brush off.
Yeah, that's called sit down, Bernie. We ain't talking. You know, mm-hmm. But that was that. And of course, that was actually the longest story ever on CBS Evening News.
Huh.
And it was 13 and a half minutes, mm-hmm, uninterrupted.
Mm-hmm.
So they took out a whole commercial break. It's only a 22-minute program.
Right.
This was 13 minutes of that 22 minutes. And it was the most accurate and best coverage we ever got.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it was about 4 years too late.
Yeah.
You know, 4 years after the dam was completed.
Right.
But I don't think it'll ever happen again today. And I think in some small way we got a part in it not happening again today.
Right. Al, tell me, let's make that our last question. Tell me, what do you mean? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I mean, David Freeman, who came in to be the chairman of the board of TVA toward the end of the Telco project, said that the project should not be completed. Well,
yeah.
If he'd have said the project shouldn't be completed, and by God, I'm not going to complete it, it'd been something different. But David had plans, and he wanted to be, you know, move up in the federal hierarchy, and then he went to the Bonneville Power Authority, and he's something out in Texas after that. But TVA boards after that, and the public generally after that, once TVA got stopped one time, it was like everything changed.
Right.
Because the perception was you can't stop TVA.
Right.
They've never been beaten. They always, whatever they do, they steamroll it and they win. Well, they don't. And the Columbia Dam over on the Duck River in Middle Tennessee, the longest undammed river in North America, TVA came in and built the Normandy Dam, which is like a 1,200 acre reservoir, just to build a dam, just so it's no longer the longest undammed river, and that was. So you couldn't use that argument to stop the Columbia Dam, which is going to be like a 12,000-acre dam. Same concept as Teleco. No generators, no flood control benefits, just redevelopment of wealth or redistribution of wealth, and redefining the community to make it, some planned bullshit like Teleco has become.
Right.
Well, they stopped that, and they took down the structure, mm-hmm. and they're about to take down the Normandy Dam. So once again, it'll be the longest undammed river in North America.
Mm-hmm.
It was so funny to see all the quote conservative Republicans when up in Rhode Island, where on some seaport they were taking away of a few blocks of private housing to redevelop the
right. Maybe New Haven,
Connecticut. Maybe it was Connecticut, okay. Bridgeport somewhere. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
But the whole country was incensed by that.
Right.
Well, hell, they're taking a couple of blocks of rundown houses.
Right.
TVA took 30,000 acres of pristine farmland, mm-hmm. Pristine river, mm-hmm. Clean water, mm-hmm. wonderful recreational opportunities, and just threw it away. And now, if you said, oh, well, it's eminent domain, it's for the benefit of the people, we're gonna take this land and build somebody a condo, everybody would be incensed by that.
Right.
And if TVA comes in and says, well, it's not going to be related to the power grid, which is what we're really supposed to be doing. It's not going to be related to flood control. But we're going to build this really neat community, and we're going to take 2,000 acres of farmland here and 4,000 acres there, and we're going to build this wonderful 6,000-acre community. Well, they'd be shot.
Right.
You're competing, first of all, with private development funds. Mm-hmm. It's the government overreaching, mm-hmm. as it was then. I mean, it's totalitarianism. It's saying, get off your land. Mm-hmm. We're smarter than you are. We got a better use for it than you have.
Mm-hmm.
And that better use is not going to be to build a hospital, state run mental health facility or even an army base or whatever, or another Oak Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
No, we're going to build golf courses for you,
mm-hmm.
because you dumb rednecks out there are not smart enough to be able to develop this the way we can.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we had some part in kind of changing the perspective if not society, at least of the perception by society that, A, all growth is not good growth, and B, the government ain't always right, and C, for damn sure, they're not here to help you. I hope we had some impact on that. Otherwise, we'd pissed away 10 years and a lot of my money,
but
I'd do it again, I might add. I did a lot better this time. I know how to do it now.
There you go.
Matter of fact, when I came back from law school, having done Teleco, I opened up as a solo practitioner here in Chattanooga, and within the first year I was here, they were going to tear down the Walnut Street Bridge.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because Provident, the big insurance company, had 13 acres there in downtown where they'd condemned out, or they bought a bunch of apartment communities and then so let them deteriorate over the 10 years that they wrote them off that they just bulldozed them all.
Yeah.
And now they got 13 acres of parking lot. They got buildings on both sides of their headquarters, buildings are on both sides of Walnut Street. They want to make sure that they could eventually close off Walnut Street to have a downtown mall. And all this stuff was 30 years ago when they were. And nobody could figure it out. I saw it. This is what they're doing, obviously, right here. They want to tear down the Walnut Street Bridge to make sure that nobody will be driving across that bridge again.
Right.
And coming through their developable property. Well, the Commissioner of Public Works, a guy named Paul Clark, nice guy, P-51 pilot in World War II, neat guy, but not very bright. Well, I'm talking to him. I said, look, and there were some people at that time that didn't want the bridge to be torn down. I said, oh, it's the oldest double camelback bridge in the country. It's a beautiful structure.
Yeah.
And it's obviously has had a huge impact on the redevelopment of Chattanooga riverfront and then the redevelopment of Chattanooga generally from a horrible foundry manufacturing town to a pretty cool place to live.
Yeah.
But Paul Clark says, well, we're going to blow that damn thing up.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing you can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And
That bridge isn't any good for anything. I mean, people are going to be driving bigger and bigger cars. Mm-hmm. This is 1978 or 9. Mm-hmm. And that bridge is just not worth anything. And I can tell you, within 3 months, it'll be in the river.
Yeah.
So, okay, watch this. You ain't TVA, partner.
Yeah.
So, with a group of friends, against folks I grew up with out in St. Elmo, Mickey Dobo, Charlie Marlin, a few other people, we started an organization called BARC, Bridge Action Resources Council.
Okay.
We go to the, do a t-shirt thing again, putting signs on the bridge, save the Walnut Street Bridge, and stuff like that. Of course, it was closed, so in theory, you couldn't be out there.
Right.
But we'd go out there and start a little civil disobedience, and we go to the city council meeting, there's nothing you can do. It's already done. The plans have been made. It's over with. Nothing you can do to stop us. Well, the next day I filed a lawsuit in federal court, got a temporary injunction because they had violated the National Historic Preservation Act. Mm-hmm. It violated, various Navigable Waterways Act. There's highway funds that you can't build or destroy bridges with without doing the EIS and that sort of thing.
Right.
And in literally in 24 hours from them being, you will not stop us, to, you stopped. You stopped, and then the Corps of Engineers comes in and said, you're not going to blow that damn thing up into the river. The Department of Interior comes in and says, that's way too valuable a piece of it. And the Transportation Department comes in and says, that thing's more structurally sound than the new interstate bridge you got over on the Ojotti Bridge.
Right.
No, you're not going to take it down. And now it's probably the most significant, other than maybe the aquarium, it's the most significant aspect of the riverfront.
Yeah.
It's a pedestrian bridge, which, again, 20, 30 years ago, well, what the hell's a pedestrian bridge?
Right.
Who would want to walk across a bridge?
Right.
Well, today, 1,000 people a day want to walk across it. They want to come to Chattanooga to walk across it.
Yeah, I walked across it last time I was here, last summer.
That's cool. It's a unique urban park that's 120 years old.
Yeah.
And as strong today as the day it was built.
Right.
It's funny, I keep talking about the Ojotti Bridge. That was, Rudy Ojotti was a mayor of Chattanooga back when I was a kid.
Okay.
And the house that my parents lived in, I lived with my parents, it was a duplex. My grandparents lived on one side of it, my parents lived on the other, and we owned it. And the mayor stopped by when he was a St. Elmo boy, too.
Okay.
He stopped by one night and said, that's my dad. He said, because the fellow named Jim Drennan was an architect with a house plan drawer. And the mayor stops by one night and says, I really like the layout of your house. My mother-in-law is going to live next door to us. Do you mind if I use your same house plan for my house? And my dad said, oh, I'd be very honored for you to do it. I appreciate that. Back then, people were much more simple about things like this.
Right.
And so the house I grew up in, two blocks down the street and across the street, it's exactly the same house, mirror imaging the house I grew up in. It's kind of weird, That has nothing to do with any of the rest of this stuff.
Right.
Although it's funny. And after that, I did a couple of, had the Battle of Sunnyside Ridge where this developer was going to take down the ridge that divides St. Elmo, the community I grew up in, from Alton Park, which is a big industrial company, and Velsa, Colorado, has a chemical plant there, did. And once again, this developer, a guy named Doug Stein Construction, they were going to take the ridge down to make a berm around a creosote plant that's now also out of business. But it's going to totally despoil the valley that's St. Elmo. Lookout Mountain on one side, Sunnyside Ridge on the other. And so this guy says, I'm seeing bringing in bulldozers and building fences for the bulldozers. So what do you got in mind here? And he said, well, I'm going to take this down to the level of Sunnyside Avenue and use it for field work. I said, no, you can't do that. That'll totally ruin the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Well, there's not a goddamn thing you can do to me. You need to get off my property.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha, partner. I'm gone.
Uh-huh.
The next day, all the trucks come in. And I lived up there by where they had the bulldozers. And we'd wait till they all come in. Another good sentimental friend of mine, Glenn Roberts, and I down at the bottom of the hill. This fellow's got a Ford van with no motor in it,
mm-hmm.
which makes it very light, needs to move. So they all get up in there, and they're illegal anyway because they're three axle truck or two axle trucks, and they're prohibited from coming down the main street that they're coming down.
Yeah.
And by signs everywhere, no two axle trucks. So they bring them all in one morning. We're down there kind of drinking coffee at the bottom of the hill at another friend's house, and we get them all in. We push the van out in the middle of 50th Street, the bottom of the hill where they're all going up into. Well, they come back down, and the damn thing won't start. We can't move it. Well, it has no motor, of course. We didn't mention that. But they can't get around it because they're too big.
Right.
Well, by God, you better... don't threaten us, you know. Mm-hmm. You're off your turf. We're on our turf. Mm-hmm. Don't threaten us. Mm-hmm. So it's about noon. And at that point, the police officer comes because they've somehow gotten around. And I've got their bulldozer tender with all their fuel and oil and hydraulic fluid and stuff stuck up there with them.
Right.
All the trucks that are contractors, they're stuck there. So the Stein Construction's paying them by the hour. They don't give a damn.
Right.
But they're pretending to give a damn. We finally, the police officer comes. Well, lo and behold, it's old Danny Rowland, another San Elmo boy who grew up at the top of the hill. Mm-hmm. Imagine that. and he's a lieutenant at this point. And hey, Danny, what's up? Well, what's the problem with the van? I said, well, I don't know. It won't start. So he says, you think we can push it out of the road? I said, yeah, we probably could. Yeah, sure. Good idea. We never thought about that. So we all get behind. We push it off the road. Danny says, and they're only going like 3 miles to this place, or 4 miles for the building the berm. Danny says, well, y'all have a good day. I'm going to take a couple hours off for lunch. I'll be out of service. Mm-hmm. So they come back in. We push the van back out. And the whole thing happens again. So they make two runs that day. That night, we go up to my house, plot this whole strategy. Sunnyside Avenue is even more narrow than 50th Street, which is more narrow than Tennessee Avenue, which they're not allowed to come down anyway. So the next day, they all pull up in there again. The truck's getting loaded up with the bulldozers and that sort of thing. And I've got a parking area at my house you can't see from the road. We have like 5 cars up there. As soon as they go in, we stagger the cars on either side of Sunnyside Avenue so they can't get out. Mm-hmm. And they're all legally parked. Mm-hmm. So they're really screwed now. They can't even get down the hill. Well, I don't know. Within the hour, a police officer comes. We got the whole organization down there. We got little old ladies crying because of the dust from the, quote, chert quarry. Mm-hmm. Not field work pit, but chert quarry. Mm-hmm. Nobody likes a quarry, you know. Those are the things I learned.
Right.
If you tag what it is.
Right.
You use the terminology. You decide what the argument's going to be, not TVA.
Right.
And not Stein Construction. So anyway, we have all these crying grandmothers and little babies and strollers and stuff, and the media's out there. Oh, it's terrible. They're putting a chert quarry in there. Who wants a quarry in a residential neighborhood? It's horrible. And the news is there, you know. Mm-hmm. The damn Stein Construction guy, he ain't nowhere around. He ain't about to be talking.
Right.
You got a couple of these guys that are truck drivers. Ah, this ain't no neighborhood. This piece of crap anyway. And don't you call my neighborhood a piece of crap. And I bet they're just, you know, like a director of an orchestra. You know, okay, now yeah, you the secret. Okay, now you.
Right.
And so finally the police come, and they're talking about it. I said, no, you need to get the city attorney out here because these trucks are illegal. Mm-hmm. And the reason they couldn't come in from the other side was that on Central Avenue, on the far side of the ridge, they'd already cut too much away. So they had a wall that they couldn't get up.
Yeah.
So they had to come from this side.
Yeah.
From the San Elmo side. We kept there all day. Finally, at the end of the day, about 5 o'clock, the city attorney does show up. He says, up, cite the trucks, they're illegal. But at that point, they decided, before the city attorney gets there, they decide they're going to tow the cars out there legally parked. Mm-hmm. Well, I thought this through, too. I went and I rented a Mercury Bobcat from the local Mercury dealer for $12 a day. And I hit it at the bottom because I figured that'd be if they were going to tow them, that'd be the first one to tow. We could prove our damages, the cost of my rental car and the inconvenience to me, so I could sue them when it came down time.
Right.
The car at the top of the hill was a little Pontiac Sunbird or something like that that belonged to one of our friends. It was a brand new car. We're towing that one. Mm-hmm. Oh, shit. She's going, no, I don't want my car towed. It's brand new. I don't know. I'm scared. So I said, okay, give me a minute. Guys, we just talked. We got our power out together. So my friend Glenn, who was down there pushing the van out with me, goes up and gets in her car like we're getting ready to leave. I get in my Bobcat. He drives down where my Bobcat is. I drive up where her car was. I say, okay, that's what's getting towed first. I understand it's $13 a day. If you do any damage to it, it belongs to Lawrence at Austin Lincoln Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
Give it your best shot.
Right.
So they tow it off, which proves, of course, that the car can get up, that a reasonable vehicle can get between that because the wrecker goes up and tows the car.
Right.
City attorney gets there and says, okay, this is all wrong. Cite the trucks, and you're enjoined from coming back. Cease and desist. It has a cease and desist order with him. He fills out in blank, gives it to the representative of Stein Construction. It's over.
Yeah.
You know, in one day, we've kicked their ass, we've humiliated them, and made them like it. Well, you know, if I had done telecom, I wouldn't know how to do that. You know,
right.
It was great
right.
fun, and it was an instant victory.
Right.
You know, 2-day victory that cost us nothing because the next day, the next week, I go to city court, and they've been holding the car for like 5 days because mm-hmm. I wasn't going to go pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
We got in city court, and I said, you know, and then they had illegal parking or something like that. No, it wasn't illegal. I showed exactly where it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was close enough to the curb. It was in the right spot.
Mm-hmm.
So the judge says, oh, that's not illegal. Dismiss it. And I said, oh, one other issue, Your Honor. And he says, actually, this is before I'd even passed the bar exam. This one happened before the Walnut Street Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, so what's that? And I said, they're still holding Lawrence Doster's car. And so the city attorney's down there and says, well, same city attorney, I might add, who said they're all illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Said, well, that's not our problem. I said, well, no.
Mm-hmm.
It was legally parked. Mm-hmm. You had yourself said they were illegal. The city towed my car, or actually towed Lawrence Doster's car. I'm liable for $13 a day in it. I want my $13 a day that I didn't have the car to drive for those. So I want $26 a day for the 5 days. You pay the towing. And Alex, I won't let you bring the car back. I'll go get it. And the guy goes, yeah, the guy's going, you asshole.
Uh-huh.
And he says, okay.
Right.
You know, right. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Let's move on.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah.
I hit Aptus all day yesterday, or a week ago. I can't do it again today. So I just gave up. It's fun. I've worn out your machine, huh?
No, that's perfect. That's perfect. I could keep going forever.
Well,
but,
let me suggest that you take that and talk to some of those other folks, the Davises and Ms. Ritchie.